You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight, we are considering the lives and the work and the continuing cultural influence of a dynamic, very special, dynamic and creative couple who made Los Angeles their final home. Aldous Huxley, the British author of the dystopian novel Brave New World, and his second wife, Laura Achira, who was a classically trained musician, lay analyst, best-selling author, and, quote, certifiable life force. The Huxleys live not far from here in Hollywood, in the Hollywood Hills, and in fact, it was, I remember seeing Laura Huxley here at a program we did on Stravinsky. It was such an honor to have her here several years ago. Our moderator and host tonight is director and producer Marianne Brabach, who met Laura Huxley through her activist work and forged a friendship that evolved into the acclaimed 2009 documentary Huxley on Huxley. And Marianne's going to show you some excerpts from that film tonight. Marianne is a veteran Hollywood documentary maker and film and TV executive who formerly served as George Lucas's development director, and she's currently working on a number of interesting film projects. And she's put together a really outstanding panel for tonight. I'm so honored to welcome these distinguished guests to Aloud. Artist Don Bacardi, whose beautiful poster of Aldous Huxley graces this month's Aloud postcard. Don's art has been recognized internationally and is included in many permanent collections of museums, including the Metropolitan, the Smithsonian, and the National Portrait Gallery in London, among others. There are numerous books on his work, and his long relationship with writer Christopher Isherwood was the focus of the 2008 documentary Chris and Don, A Love Story. Very beautiful film. Anne-Louise Bardach is the award-winning author of Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, and Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana. She's also the editor of The Prison Letters of Fidel Castro, as well as Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. She's a reporter for The Daily Beast and for Newsweek, and was a contributing editor at Vanity Fair for 10 years. And John Densmore is an original and founding member of the influential music group The Doors, the one and only Doors. His autobiography, Writers on the Storm, was a New York Times bestseller. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993. His journalism has been published in The Nation, The Guardian, and Rolling Stone, and he's also worked in film as a producer and a screenwriter. So Marianne will fill you in on each of the panelists' relationship to tonight's topic, and she'll also be introducing some excerpts from her beautiful film. Afterwards, we will open it up to you for Q&A, so please wait until the microphones come to you as we do record for podcasts. And afterwards, our guests will be signing tonight in the lobby. Please welcome Marianne Brabach. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to show some clips from the documentary I made about Huxley's last decade, which is the time that he was married to Laura Achira Huxley, his second wife. And but before that, I just wanted to say a few more things about Huxley that might not be so well known. That, I mean, he was known as a brilliant critic of modern society, and he wrote over 50 books, essays, articles, and screenplays. But in addition to that, he was considered, you know, simply one of the greatest writers of the 20th century and one of the great visionaries of the 20th century. I mean, as early as the 1930s, he was writing about global warming and overpopulation, and in the 1940s, he was writing about, you know, jockeying for Arab oil, and he was really way ahead of his time. And his writings and were all tied to his beliefs about society's misplaced values and overconsumption. And that last decade of his life was really devoted to books about, you know, that were sort of cautionary tales for the world, and also to his explorations of psychedelics. So anyway, we're going to watch the clips, and then we'll I'll talk about the panelists after we've done watch the clips and start the questions. Thanks.
I met Aldous in 1948. And I had a movie in mind that had to be shot in Tuscany, in Siena. It's actually the Palio di Siena. It's a wonderful festival that takes place there. And I asked John Huston, what do you do when you want to make a movie? And he said, you have to get yourself a writer and a director and a star. So, well, I heard about this writer who wrote a book about babies in bottles.
Brave New World is a fantastic parable about the dehumanization of human beings. In the negative utopia described in my story, man has been subordinated to his own inventions.
And I never made the film, but I made a wonderful friendship and then a wonderful life with all this. Yes, this is my favorite place in the world. It's so full of light and so free, and it could be anywhere, you know. You don't know where we are here. Yeah? Well, of course, if you see that, we do. On Saturday, sometimes we had very interesting people for lunch, some well-known and some not well-known.
There were dinners at the Huxley's with Gerald Hurd, certainly, and the Stravinsky's. They were close to the Huxley's, and I remember Chris and Aldous and Igor deeply engaged in literary talk. I think Igor had loved having literary conversations with Chris and Aldous.
I remember one time that Igor Stravinsky came, and he was also familiar with the lady that cooked, Marie Leput, because she had cooked for him too. And that day, he went to the kitchen and said, Marie, I cannot eat your food because I'm on a special diet. So then he came to the table, and he had two things. On one side, he had baby food, and on the other hand, he had whiskey. And that is what he ate all lunch, and whiskey and baby food. And at the end of the luncheon, it was quite high.
Things.
What made me want to try mescaline LSD? I never thought of what made me. It was a natural thing that Aldous spoke about it. I read the book, and it's an exploration, and I like exploration.
You've even written about the use of drugs in this light.
Well, now, this is a very interesting subject. I mean, I think it's quite on the cards that we may have drugs which will profoundly change our mental states without doing us any harm. I mean, this is the pharmacological revolution which has taken place.
Humphrey Osman, who was a great chemist, told Huxley about the powers of mescaline and gave him some, and then the experience was reported in Aldous's book, The Doors of Perception.
You know, we were kicking around band names, and I was in Ray's, our keyboard player's VW Beetle. Jim was in the passenger seat, and he turned around and said, hey, how about The Doors? I said, Doors. Well, that's short, you know. And then Ray explained that he got the idea from the Huxley book, Doors of Perception.
When it happened that Aldous was arriving at MIT at just the same time that Timothy Leary was at Harvard, so why it wasn't long before they got together, and that changed history. It brought on the psychedelic 60s.
When I found that he was just down the road, Massachusetts Avenue, with real trembling awe, I picked up the phone and called down there, and there was this man I idolized. And I explained to him what we were doing, and he said, now let me get this straight. You chaps over there at Harvard, you have authority to use psychedelic drugs and to research consciousness? And I said, yes, sir. He said, what's your address? I'm getting a cab and I'll be there in 5 minutes.
This was a time when the substances were not only legal, but they were respectable.
Tim was far out. And Aldous would.
I was with Aldous, and he said, you know, Tim is one of the most charismatic people I know, but why in God's name does he have to be such an ass?
Enormous crowds come out to hear me lecture. Whenever I go to a college, it's always sold out. It's not because I'm that clever. It's because they gave me the good lines in the show. Turn on, tune in, drop on.
I knew Tim, Leary, but yes, Huxley and he disagreed, and I'm on Aldous' side on that one. I mean, Tim was saying, you know, we all should have LSD every Sunday, and I mean, it was, you know, those proposals didn't work out.
Aldous wanted to save these chemicals for use of the learned people, and I was in the middle between you and Aldous and Tim, because I ran sessions with Flowers and all kinds. But Tim and Aldous took exception to one another because Tim wanted to spread this stuff all over society.
Yes, well, he was a public man. Tim was typically a public man. He felt good in the public. But you see, what
I love that characterization of Tim.
Indeed.
A public man.
Yes.
Was Aldous a public man?
No, he was a very private man.
Aldous, you know, came out of the literary elite of England. And, I mean, he was academic literary royalty. So that gives you a certain freedom to get away with things.
A higher level of consciousness, how that influenced the Doors' music.
Yeah. Well, first I want to say it's an honor to be on this illustrious panel, and I want to thank the library, and I want to thank Mary Ann for working so hard for tonight. Jim Morrison was reading Nietzsche and Blake and Huxley, and Huxley's experiments in delving into higher consciousness was directly influenced into what we were up to. Rock star was not in our vernacular, let alone the hyped up caffeinated energy drink. We were interested in higher states of consciousness, and as Houston Smith, the scholar on comparative religions, said, it was legal at the time, psychedelics, and we were kind of respectable street scientists. I would say that the lyrics to Break On Through are directly related to that. So I'm going to mess around with that here for a second. This is Jim's words. Day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Tried to run, tried to hide. Break on through to the other side. Made the scene week to week, day to day, hour to hour, gay to straight, deep and ride, break on through to the other side. You can see why I'm the drummer, not the singer.
Yeah.
So yes, Marianne, I took LSD. You know, but I quickly learned that it is very strong medicine, dangerous, in fact. And like the Native Americans who have their peyote ceremonies, it needs boundaries. And you know, they have a road man who's a guide, and you stay in the teepee all night. And that kind of made me seek out something else, less shattering to my nervous system, which was meditation. And I happened to fall into Maharishi's class here in the States a couple of years before the Beatles, and opened up a whole world of Eastern thought. And I think Annie's going to talk a little bit about the Vedanta Society that Aldous got into right in the 40s when he came over here. So, you know, really ahead of our time. I'm just thinking about psychedelics, and I'm thinking of a Goethe line, "Tell a wise man or else keep silent. The mass man will mock it right away." So I'm kind of with Aldous on this, you know, it's a powerful, psychedelics need to be kind of carefully dealt with. Next question.
Well, I'm going to talk to Annie a little bit about Vedanta, but I wanted to ask Don something about the 50s, but I didn't want to exclude you from the psychedelic conversation. So. I actually was going to read an entry from Chris Isherwood's diaries in June 22nd, 1956. And this is quotes, "Aldous and Gerald are having frequent lysergic acid sessions. I'm slightly mad at both, rather childishly, I admit, because they snoot of my experience and tell people that my mescaline is of inferior make. I am sure the Huxleys persuaded Humphrey Osmond not to give me any 2 years ago." but I wanted to ask you about Huxley's, we've sort of heard about the 60s, but Huxley in the 50s and what his, you know, the Hollywood circle was like, a Huxley circle, and that relationship between Stravinsky and Isherwood and Huxley. What was that, the bond between their...
And Gerald Hurd.
And Gerald Hurd, yes.
They were certainly good friends, but not good enough friends that Aldous and Gerald particularly would share their LSD with Chris. and he was longing to participate in these sessions, and they were very possessive and wouldn't include him. And he finally had to go out and purchase some from a pharmacist in New York and have his own experience. And I was with him one day in London when he took it devoted the whole day to having a very good time with it.
Aldous.
Laura once gave Chris and me each a tablet of LSD, and I hadn't understood that half of the tablet was a very strong dose, and I took the entire tablet, and I had a day of absolute phenomenal experience, from a really ecstatic joy to real terror, and I carefully took it on a day when Chris was in Santa Barbara teaching, and right away I realized it was way out of my the territory of my expectations, and I so regretted not having Chris there. And he was very disapproving when he got home that evening and heard the tale of my day of panic.
Well, but I also wanted to ask you about the relationship between Stravinsky and Chris and Huxley. What was the sort of the strong bond and between the three of them?
Clearly enjoyed each other's company. The great bond between Chris and Igor was that Igor was determined to regard Chris as totally unmusical, because it was such a relief to him to know somebody who didn't call him maestro.
Oh.
And wasn't a devoted fan of his music. And he really wanted to just talk literature with Chris or just talk gossip. And, of course, Vera and Robert Kraft were sharing the house together, and the three of them were the people Chris and I were fondest of spending an evening with, either in their house on Weatherly Drive or in Santa Monica. And there were many wonderful evenings.
Can I disagree with Igor? Chris's writing is musical in the sentences. I hear it.
Well, words were music to Chris, yes. And of course he enjoyed music a great deal, but he didn't interfere with Igor for being convinced that he was unmusical.
Well, I wanted to jump to sort of Vedanta and mysticism, which is something that an area that Annie's very knowledgeable about. And ask you about Huxley and Isherwood's involvement in the Vedanta Society. But I think maybe first, actually, I was going to have you explain what Vedanta Society is. And also, I mean, Huxley was an agnostic, and his grandfather, Thomas, the biologist and colleague of Darwin's, Thomas Henry Huxley, coined the word agnostic in 1869. So it was interesting that someone who was a proclaimed agnostic came from a long line of agnostics, became very interested in mysticism and really devoted a good portion of his life to it.
First of all, I'm not a theologian by any means, and I have a kind of backwards way into this. I just thought I'd mention this, is the way I had read Huxley when I was in high school and college by way of introduction here, and in 1969, I was at NYU School of the Arts, and just to connect where this goes for me, and Trev Huxley, who was the grandson of Aldous's, was at school with me, and John Stravinsky, who was the grandson of Igor Stravinsky. So I was in class at NYU School of the Arts I found out later that Trev was never enrolled, that he was just hanging out, and he had long blonde hair to his waist, and long story short is Trev introduced us to LSD, and which I don't think I ever would have gone down that road, except it was Trev Huxley, and he said my grandfather had done this work, and etc. And so it was John Stravinsky. I can't believe the three of us. And it was the New York City garbage strike. But it was an interesting experience. The 6 feet of garbage and psychedelic, full psychedelia. And I kept anyway. But going before Huxley gets involved with psychedelics or all this, he's basically a spiritual seeker, and he came to the United States in 1937, and I think because of Gerald Hurd, who was then a really prominent, important person, great English essayist, etc. And they became connected to, they heard about the Vedanta Society here in L.A. up above Franklin Boulevard. And they heard about a very charismatic teacher named Prabhadanda. And in fact, one of the nuns, who's now 90, wrote me last night that they kept trying to make contact with him and they kept going to the wrong place, Gerald Hurd and Huxley. And in any event, they did hook up with Swami Prabhadanda, who was, you know, just an extraordinary spiritual teacher, and became very involved in Vedanta, which is, I guess if you had to do it in a nutshell, sort of like the Unitarianism of the East, and but based on the Vedas, which are, you know, something like 6,000 years old and precede, you know, Buddhism, you know, Hinduism, actually, though, again, I'm not a theologian here. But Huxley became very involved and very devoted, and not as much, as I might add, as Christopher Isherwood, who became, at one point, I think, considered even becoming a monk at one point. And Christopher Isherwood, in fact, translates with Prabhavananda into English the Bhagavad Gita, and Aldous Huxley writes the introduction. But, and that I think is in 44, but in 1942, for the first time in English is translated the Gospel of Ramakrishna. And Ramakrishna is regarded somewhat as, he is regarded as a saint or an avatar in India, and was sort of the guiding light. And Aldous Huxley wrote the preface, the foreword to the Gospel of Ramakrishna, thus making it much more accessible. And he would pretty much regularly go up to the Little Vedanta Society off Ivar here, and he would lecture, he would talk, he became very close to Prabhavananda, and he was so serious. I mean, again, he was not as serious as I don't think Christopher Isherwood, but in 1952, he has to be initiated. His wife, Maria, was also very, very close to the Vedantists, the nuns, and particularly Prabhavananda. The problems began, and he was very close through 1955. In 1955, Maria, who was very much beloved and regarded as a saint, she died. And the second wife, Laura, was not very interested in Vedanta, was not particularly popular in this world with that group, or with, you know, there was a lot of problems for her as the second wife, and she was much more partial to the psychedelics, which he was already exploring. And at that point, he doesn't become like a regular visitor. That's kind of what happens. Is that I think he always had a very close relationship with Prabhavananda, but Laura really doesn't like it, and she doesn't want to go there anymore, and his relationship becomes more private, and he stops basically in 56, 57, giving lectures and talks there. And he's no longer writing some of these works, and we can go a little further with that. Prabhavananda was quite a saintly figure, and the nuns there, they don't, you know, really say anything negative about anybody. But I did ask him what was their feeling about Aldous Huxley, and he said something to the effect that Aldous was a man of tremendous intellect, tremendous genius, but he lacked discrimination. And that's a very subtle little thing, but it's such a interesting comment to come from somebody like Prabhavananda. I think we covered that.
Yeah, okay. Well, John, we can follow up with a question. You started to talk about meditation, and I don't think you were involved in the Vedanta Society, but I know you were involved in transcendental meditation. And how your practice is, do you feel it's all indebted to Huxley and Isherwood and the sort of paths they forged with their interest in mysticism and Eastern religions?
A tab of LSD had more effect than the communion wafer in Catholic Church. But as I said, meditation was a less shattering route, and I'm still into it. That's a slower, lifelong sort of keep your center kind of thing. What was your question? See how centered I am?
I think you answered it. Okay. I was going to ask you, Don, about the book that Chris and Aldous collaborated on, Jacob's Hands, and which was a spiritual fable, or it wasn't a book, actually. I guess it was a screenplay.
Right? It wasn't even a screenplay. It was a treatment.
A treatment.
For a screenplay. And I think Aldous and certainly Chris would have been horrified to be told that the book was published as a novel by the two of them. Laura wanted to do it, and I thought, well, if Laura wants to do it as executor of the Isherwood estate, I joined her because I didn't want to thwart her, but I know Chris would have been thoroughly against it, would never have allowed it himself, but I just didn't want to deny Laura. But there's really no indication anywhere in the publication that the book wasn't intended as a novel, that it's really a treatment.
Right.
Not
you're
even
right.
a screenplay.
Yeah. And I read, too, that it's like when Aldous pitched it to Warner Brothers, they said no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, and quite yeah. rightly, it yeah. was so bare.
Yeah. Well, I was curious how they could, for these two people, men to work together and what that collaboration was like.
I think it was just the bare bones of a story. Had they gotten the go-ahead, they would have enriched it, of course.
Yeah.
But, and it was a very unlikely project, it seems to me, particularly at that time, to write something with a spiritual theme. And I'm not surprised they didn't get a producer to right. back it.
Right. So, okay. Actually, there was something else I wanted to ask you, too, about Aldous's influence on Chris. Mm-hmm. Because you were talking about Stravinsky earlier, and there was an excerpt I read from Chris's diary, which I thought was rather humorous, about Stravinsky and going to a concert. And Chris said, this is the quotes, "Of course I didn't enjoy the music. I didn't expect to. It seems chiefly to consist of nervous stabbing sounds. Yet I believe it when Aldous, looking more beautifully slim and distinguished than I'd ever seen him, called Igor a great genius, a saint of music, and the maker of the Stravinsky Revolution." Mm-hmm. So I was just, wanted to ask you, in what way, what influences Aldous had over Chris and his sort of likes and dislikes and other examples.
Which piece did they hear?
He didn't say in the diary, so I don't know which piece. I don't know if you were there with him. It was 1957, so I have to go back.
Yes, it was late Stravinsky, and it was that choral piece of his. It's gone out of my mind, but anyway, Igor didn't regard Chris as a music lover, his comments wouldn't have offended him in the least. But I was surprised. I was reading passages in Chris's diaries this morning about Aldous, and there was one passage after they'd known each other a couple of years, I think, in which Chris said that finally Aldous had gotten over his shyness, and they could really make communication. I think they weren't naturally drawn to each other. They were completely different kinds of writers, but I know they did establish a relationship that was really based on a great sympathy with each other.
Well, because they came over here around the same time.
Aldous and Gerald Hurd actually arrived in 37, and Chris didn't come until 39.
Right.
And I don't think Chris and Aldous had known each other in England at all.
Right, I think they just knew of each other through Gerald.
Yes.
Right.
The other point is that in both the Bhagavad Gita and the Gospel of Ramakrishna, the editors and in the preface, Isherwood thanks Huxley for being collaboratively supportive in the translations. And so I think that they were, and he helped with both translations, which were, you know, tremendous undertakings, you know.
Right.
And although he only put his name on the forewords. But
did Chris ever say what books of Aldous's were his favorites?
After Many a Summer, I know, was, I think the one he would have chosen as his favorite, but he didn't really feel that Aldous was comfortable as a novelist. He much preferred his theoretical writings, his nonfiction, and read all of those books I know, great admiration for them.
Great. Well, I wanted to ask Annie, too, about Huxley, because I know you had spoken to Christopher, your colleague and friend Christopher Hitchens, who wrote the foreword to Brave New World Revisited. And you were talking to him about the foreword, and I just wanted to ask you, you know, and also in that foreword he mentions that Huxley was, because Brave New World is often compared to 1984, but George Orwell was actually Huxley's pupil at Eton. Because right after Huxley graduated Oxford, he couldn't get anything published. It was before Chrome Yellow. Mm-hmm. And so he was teaching French literature at Eton, and Orwell was his student. And then that Orwell, I think, didn't acknowledge Brave New World for a long time.
Right.
But so that's mentioned in Hitchens.
Yeah.
Forward, but
that's an amazing piece of literary trivia.
Yeah,
I mean, I didn't know it either till Marianne, you know, showed me Hitch's preface. So he writes the new foreword to these forewords are amazing. And Huxley is Orwell's teacher. This is what Hitch said today. Christopher Hitchens, who is actually quite ill, and he's been public about that, so I'll mention that. And Marianne and I were talking about it, that Aldous Huxley died of cancer of the tongue, as you said, and Hitchens has the esophagus, and they both were very concerned about their voice. And Marianne was telling me about how Huxley did not have surgery for fear of the voice. And anyway, so apropos of that, and so I wrote Hitch about that, and he said he wanted me to tell people that his voice has come back. and not just his literary voice. He's getting treatment at a hospital, but his feeling is that, similar to Christopher Isherwood's, that he thinks Orwell is in a class of his own. He's a huge Orwell aficionado and just thinks Orwell is just tremendous and the better novelist, but he thinks that Huxley is part of the gold standard, as he said, but not the great novelist, more of the polemicist, the great essayist. You know, he said he was tremendously admirer of his, you know, thinking, his visionary, etc. I was thinking, but reading Hitch's preface to Brave New World, I mean, I don't know, this is a thought I just had, you know, with the whole thing about pill consciousness and all this, the irony that, well, we'll get to this with Marianne, is about him taking LSD at the end, where you wonder about, it's almost like, a kind of a fatal irony almost, that about consciousness, spiritual consciousness, and pharmaceutical spiritual consciousness. But which, anyway, he writes a really interesting introduction. But he thinks he's going to stay in the pantheon, and the legacy is really is tremendous, but more in terms of the thinking and the ideas.
Yeah, I mean, because he's known as one of the great visionaries of the 20th century,
yes.
So I think that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. John, I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, we've already mentioned that Aldous and Maria, his first wife, came to the States in 37, is it because they were really, he was an ardent pacifist, as was Isherwood, and they were fleeing the buildup of the war in Europe, and that's how he first came here and ended up in California. And I know that you've, written about pacifism, and you have certain views on the use of Doors music and war films and battle films. And so I just, wanted to ask you about any kind of, if you could elaborate on your connection you feel to Huxley and how relevant those, his views and how relevant they are today.
Mm, yeah. well, that's a hard road. I won't fight against Hitler. Okay. Amazing. When one has to cross that line of no return of killing another human being, I would say the psyche is altered. And World War II vets are for the most part okay, because the enemy was clear. Vietnam vets, Iraqi vets are a mess. And here's Aldous as a pacifist in World War II, which is like, whoa. It's pushing a shift in consciousness, I think. It's kind of like the Michael Franti lyric, you can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb the world into peace. And so it's pretty relevant for today, with Iran and Pakistan. And there's another line, Paul Simon's new album, man becomes machine, oil running down his face. No, man invents machine, oil running down his face, man becomes machine, bombs in the marketplace. So, and I think about Japan and the nuclear, plutonium could be a bomb, and oh boy.
And also, it's... Huxley was a pacifist who escaped Europe. I think it's easier to be a pacifist when you're out of town. I'm not trying to pass judgment, but I'm just saying you're out.
So. Well, it was controversial. He was highly criticized for it. I mean, because he was a pacifist in World War I and had been dedicated, and so yeah.
William Stafford was a wonderful poet who was also a pacifist during World War II. So the Native Americans say think seven generations down the road, and how long does plutonium last? 10,000, whatever it is. And I heard a story about some powers that be in D.C. having a dialogue about, if somebody discovers a nuclear dump site, they might not speak English, so we got to figure out what to do here. This is insanity. And Huxley knew this 60 years before. So.
Yeah. Well, I think we're running to the end, coming the near end of the program. So.
I was just going to make one mention of that, what that might have impacted of his pacifism. I'm not sure about this, but his brother had taken his life. His brother Trevenin.
Right.
This is what I heard from Trev, his grandson, that he was named for this. And this kind of, he said, cast a shadow, more than a shadow. I sometimes wonder about that, his experience with personal familial violence being, and with his pacifism, and I don't know, I'd be curious to know if it evolved down, you know, and he had, after World War II, I'm not sure if he changed his mind about what was the right reaction to Nazism. Be curious if he still thought pacifism was the way. If anyone knows. No.
I think we'd like to sort of end the evening with hearing some two passages from Huxley's book, so we can leave you with some of his literary wit. And Annie's going to read a passage from After Many a Summer Dies, The Swan, which was published in 1939 and was the first book that Huxley wrote after he moved to California. And it's the antagonist of the book is this evil tycoon who's actually modeled after William Randolph Hearst. And
do you want me to do that now?
Yeah, if you want to read that. And then John's,
Brave New
after
World.
Annie Fish, I'll introduce what John's reading.
Okay. All right, this is from the very beginning of After Many a Summer Dies the Swan, when Huxley, when the character has just arrived in downtown L.A. at the train. Okay. A few minutes later, they were on their way. Cradled in the back seat of the car, out of range, he hoped of the chauffeur's conversation, Jeremy Portage abandoned himself to the pleasure of merely looking. Southern California rolled past the windows. All he had to do was to keep his eyes open. The first thing to present itself was a slum of Africans and Filipinos, Japanese and Mexicans. And what permutations and combinations of black, yellow, and brown. What complex bastardies. And the girls, how beautiful in their artificial silk. And the Negro ladies in white muslin gowns, his favorite line in the prelude. He smiled to himself, and meanwhile the slum had given place to the tall buildings of a business district. The population took on a more Caucasian tinge. At every corner there was a drugstore. The newspaper boys were selling headlines about Franco's drive on Barcelona. Most of the girls, as they walked along, seemed to be absorbed in silent prayer. But he supposed on second thought it was only gum that was thus incessantly ruminating. Gum, not God. Then suddenly the car plunged into a tunnel and emerged into another world, a vast, untidy suburban world of filling stations and billboards of low houses and gardens, of vacant lots and waste paper, of occasional shops and office buildings and churches, primitive Methodist churches built, surprisingly enough, in the style of the Cartuja at Granada. Catholic churches like Canterbury Cathedral, synagogues disguised as Hagia Sophia, Christian Science churches with pillars and pediments like banks. It was a winter day and early in the morning, but the sun shone brilliantly. The sky was without a cloud. The car was traveling westwards in the sunshine, slanting from behind them as they advanced, lit up each building, each sky sign, and billboard as though with a spotlight, and though on purpose to show the new arrivals all the sights. Eats, cocktails, open nights, jumbo malts. Do things, go places with Consul Supergas. At Beverly Pantheon, fine funerals are not expensive.
Thank you.
This is my copy of Brave New World from the 60s. It's dog-eared. And I read it again, and I think there's a correlation between this little excerpt, well, this futuristic masterpiece, and something Jim Morrison wrote in American Prayer. So I'm going to read a little part. Everyone in this book is searching, it's a utopian society searching for happiness at any cost, and anytime you have
any emotions or feeling, you anesthetize it quickly with soma. It's a conversation between the, I love this, the arch community songster of Canterbury and the controller, and they're saying about the masses, we can't make them lose their faith in happiness as the sovereign good, capital S, capital G, and take to believing instead that the goal was somewhere beyond, somewhere outside the present human sphere, that the purpose of life was not the maintenance of well-being, soma, but some intensification and refining of consciousness, some enlargement of knowledge, which was, the controller reflected, quite possibly true, but not in the present circumstance. Not in the present circumstance admissible. He picked up his pen again and, under the words "not to be published," drew a second line thicker and blacker than the first, then sighed. What fun it would be, he thought, if one didn't have to think about happiness. It's Morrison. Death makes angels of us all and gives us wings where we once had shoulders smooth as raven's claws. No more money, no more fancy dress. This other kingdom seems by far the best, but its other jaw reveals incest and a loose obedience to a vegetable law. I will not go. Prefer a feast of friends to the giant family. Let's reinvent the gods, all the myths of the ages. Celebrate symbols from deep elder forests. We need great golden copulations. Have we forgotten the lessons of the ancient war? Do you know we are being led to slaughters by placid admirals and that fat, slow generals are getting obscene on young blood? Wow. I'm sick of doubt. I'm sick of dour faces staring at me from the TV tower. I want roses in my garden bower. Dig royal rubies. Oh, great creator of being, grant us one more hour to perform our art and perfect our lives.
A accompanied Maria when she was dying, according to the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And so I knew that he wanted the same thing for himself. And in fact, he made it so clear that on the last morning, he was dying, and he said to me, give me a big piece of paper. And so I did. So he wrote 100 microgram LSD intramuscular, which was the usual thing that we did. It was a strange day, because here he was dying, and usually the house is very quiet. And all of a sudden, I heard that in the next room, somebody had put on the television.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
And it was so incredible. These two men died the same day, dying in such a different circumstances. Two men who had tried their best for humanity, and one dying in such a violent way, and others in the most gentle, in the most really enlightened way. After the injection, I asked him, do you hear me? Squeeze my hand. And he squeezed my hand. And so the second time he did not squeeze my hand again. And it went on. And then the breathing ceased, as though when you play music and you go into diminuendo, into a final pause. It was really extraordinary death. He had that almost a smile in his face that I knew very well, that smile.
Okay, give us some trouble.
Yes.
Yes. Stir it up.
Well, I was going to say actually one thing about John, before John read Brave New World, is that it's amazing that 79 years later, it's still being published in 20 languages, and I think 100,000 copies a year are sold, which is pretty amazing. Whoa. Not close to the Doors albums, but sorry. It's a long ways to catch up.
Okay. Numbers.
All right. I'd like to, you know, ask a question that kind of triggered by it with Laura Huxley, that humorous moment in the first clip when she said, "Oh, we can be anywhere," but she was in Hollywood, and the people we're talking about were in Los Angeles. And I, as a native, you know, the Doors, Los Angeles band, I'd like maybe you can speak to the influence of Los Angeles, both for them and how they influenced it, but how it, Los Angeles influenced Huxley and Carty and Isherwood and the Doors, and as an entity unto itself. And Leary was here. This is a special place, and I'd like to hear you speak about the city in the context of Huxley's.
Well, I mean, I can think, I can just talk about for Huxley, for instance, and I don't know if anyone else wants to add to it, but I think certainly the city had a big effect on him. When he first arrived here, he worked at the studios. He was part of the, you know, the movie scene, and I think good friends with Chaplin and Garbo, and wasn't that their circle? And it was, so he was very much a part of sort of the Hollywood circle. And then after living here for some time, he moved to the desert, which had a big effect on him. He loved the desert. And so I think he went back and forth, actually, between the city and the desert. But it's like the whole, and he also stayed here because he had an eye, he was really legally blind. He had contracted an eye disease when he was a teenager, and he moved here to work with a particular person who was helping him and with the Bates Eye Method. So there were, you know, personally it had many effects on him, and then also becoming involved in the Vedanta Society and mysticism, so it was a major effect.
I just got into town about an hour ago. Took a look around, see which way the wind blows. Are you a lucky little lady in the city of lights, or just another lost angel, city at night? Never saw a woman so alone. Cops and cars, the topless bars. L.A. woman, you're my woman.
I know Chris adored the city, California in general, and Los Angeles, Santa Monica particularly. All of the best things in his life happened to him here. He never regretted leaving England. He would go back to see his friends in London, but after a week or two, he couldn't wait to get back to California. So it was a major benefit to him, personally.
Great.
Thanks to everyone tonight, especially those words of wisdom that using LSD is not to be done lightly, and it can be dangerous. I'm an Orwell man. His major works were in reaction to the Soviet Union, and he wrote them 2 and 3 decades after the Soviet Union came into existence. I want to mention the first dystopian novelist, Yevgeny Zamyatin, who wrote his great novel We, in 1923. He didn't need 2 decades to think about the dystopia that was coming into existence. And he was also some kind of genius because Stalin let him go away to the West.
That question over here.
She acknowledged it.
Wow, that was good. Thanks for this wonderful event. I really appreciate it. And early on in the movie, talked about Huxley being ahead of his time. Martha Graham said that great artists aren't ahead of their time. They are their time. So let's put it to our time right now. Igor Stravinsky said, most people don't know what they like. They like what they know. So we're sitting in this nice, wonderful building, and we're all prosperous, and there's poor people dying right outside the building in the gutter. So, you know, Huxley was commenting on overconsumption. So would he just say embrace this contradiction or what?
Excuse me, can you just clarify, like, which contradiction are you talking about embracing?
That we're just one big happy family celebrating literature tonight, but there are people dying outside the door here. And he spoke directly about that, overconsumption. So it seems like there's a contradiction. And how do you think he would speak to that contradiction? Would he say embrace the contradiction, or maybe would he say something else?
Well, I guess you might say his life would be then a contradiction, because he certainly talked about overconsumption, but didn't prevent him from enjoying an evening with Isherwood and Stravinsky and having, you know, and having a social life as well. So I'm not sure if that satisfies your...
We've become too good at survival, and so Mother Nature is going to take care of it.
You know, I was going to say something about his vision.
It's like Gaia, again, the Earth, is this woman, and she has these rashes on her body called cities, and every once in a while she goes...
It was interesting that he had his spiritual quest, and I was wondering if he had any knowledge or research into the alchemical arts, you know, in search of like a philosopher's stone type of ideal.
Where's who's that? It's hard to see.
Is the question? I'm sorry.
Did Huxley have any research or knowledge of the alchemical arts?
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, he clearly understood that, or he believed that there was more to life than just our ordinary perception. He had that belief long before he heard about drugs. It's why he was, you know, fairly ardent Vedantist for a period. I also think another factor in his spiritual search is that, he, as Marianne said, he was afflicted with near blindness, and he knew that, you know, he was always fighting for the light and vision, and so I think that in some ways it made him go within, knowing that at some point that could close, you know, he could lose that. You know, the whole thing with LSD, I think, is, you know, just obviously a very hot-button controversial issue with him. But I, as he talked about it, or as Don was saying about his feeling about keeping it for certain very specified, you know, he had that disagreement with Leary, who I think he recognized had some other very serious problems that the LSD, whatever, and that he saw it much more differently than that. regarding, you know, how he died, which has been discussed at great length, I mean, we only have Laura Huxley's version of that. It's unlikely that if she gave it to him and it he had a terribly bad trip, that she was going to tell us that was the you know, we don't know. We only know what she has told us. And she wasn't popular with the family. There was dissension between her and his son and the grandchildren and the estate, which remained until the end, you know, in terms of who had the estate, which she did have. Not that I'm saying that I don't think, we just don't know exactly. We don't know what happened to him in those final minutes. We only know her version. So,
But Annie, he was dying of cancer.
So yeah, no, that he was dying of cancer. Yeah. But I mean that his final experience was this great ecstatic experience that should suggest other people might want to do that. I would just say take it with a grain of salt, because we only have one version on that.
Thank you. I wonder if any of you could comment on the influence that Krishnamurti had on Mr. Huxley's writings. I know they spent a great deal of time together in Ojai and also in the Happy Valley School in Ojai. I don't know.
Right. Well, I know that Krishnamurti wrote the foreword to Huxley's book on the art of seeing. I know they had a close relationship. I don't know really in depth about the relationship, but I know that they were very good friends. And I know Huxley was one of the founders of that school. And the art of seeing was, he was a man that was almost blind. And he had, in regards to his sight, he wanted to be a scientist. That was his dream. And he wanted to be a doctor, and he had to give that up when he lost most of his sight. I just know that, I don't really know the details of their relationship, except that there was a lot of respect for each other.
And at every talk Krishnamurti gave, he started by saying, don't take what the speaker here is saying as gospel. He was adamant about that.
That might be a good note to end on, but we want to thank our wonderful panel, and thank you all for coming tonight. Thank you so much.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.